A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, yes, there you are. Excellent. It's me, Joe Haddo, and welcome to another episode of Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. Later on the podcast, my two guests will each be pitching a book that they love and think that everyone should read, and I'll be tasked with choosing which one to take home. Of course, you may disagree. Today, I'm joined by a screenwriter and Sunday Times best-selling author whose debut novel, The Outcast, won the Costa First Novel Award. She's just published her fifth novel, The Snakes, to great acclaim. Sadie Jones, welcome to Book Off.
Hi.
Lovely to see you. And my second guest is the author of the acclaimed novels The Unseen World and Heft, which was recently optioned as a feature film. She's just landed from the US to join us today. Welcome, Liz Moore.
Thank you so much.
So great to have you both here on this wet, rainy, grey, miserable January afternoon. Liz, if I could start with you to talk about Long Bright River. This is your latest novel, and it's just been published. And it took you a long time, didn't it, to feel ready to even write this book?
Yeah, the very sort of the first seed that was planted of Long Bright River was back in 2009, when I moved to Philadelphia and first encountered a neighborhood called Kensington there, which is very different than the Kensington here in that it is a working class neighborhood that's been particularly hard hit by the opioid crisis that's going on in the States. So the book is sort of about that, and it's the story of two sisters, one of whom is suffering from opioid addiction and she goes missing at the start of the novel, and the other of whom is a police officer who takes it upon herself to go looking for her sister.
And it's a page turner, but it's also dealing with quite a lot of serious issues, obviously. And I wondered how you found writing that balance between it reading, you know, really fast and getting to know those characters and also dealing with this crisis, as you say.
You're right that it is a very careful balance, and it's one that I thought about a lot. I think there's a human instinct to want to listen to stories rather than be told a moral. And so it was important to me not to moralize in the telling of this book. But it was also important to me to offer new understandings of people with addiction and also the family members of people with addiction. Mm. It's not interesting to me artistically to tell the same stories that have been told over and over again and to use the same stereotypes about both parties. So I tried to offer new understandings of both sides of the issue through the mechanism of what I hope is also sort of a propulsive story.
Yeah. Oh, it absolutely is. And you spent a lot of time, I believe, talking to people on Kensington Ave.
Like many families in the States, but probably like many families, period. My own family has a long kind of history of addiction. And so there was kind of a autobiographical pull toward the neighborhood for that reason. I first went there as part of a photojournalism project, but I only went a handful of times that year back in 2009. But I felt drawn back to the neighborhood over and over again, and I ended up doing community work there and teaching free writing workshops at a women's day shelter. And many of the clients there were also suffering from addiction to opioids. Some weren't. Some were experiencing, poverty or difficulties of other kinds. But through that work, I became pretty well acquainted with the neighborhood and started to think seriously about setting a novel there.
Hmm.
And that became Long Bright River.
And the title is taken from a poem.
Yeah, the title
is... a line of a poem.
That's right. The title is from a poem called The Lotus Eaters by Tennyson.
Which I didn't know, actually, until I read it at the very beginning of the book.
Yeah, the phrase comes from that poem, but then I sort of retrofitted it into a few other scenes in the book.
Yeah.
And it's a phrase that I ended up feeling had resonance in multiple ways with some of the other things happening in the book.
I'll come back to talk a bit more about your characters, if I may, Liz. I just want to talk to Sadie about the stakes and also about Tennyson, because I don't know about you, but I remember studying Tennyson at school and just being sort of like, oh, this guy and this lady and this shallot or whatever it is. I'm so over
it. He's kind of a terrible poet. I should not say that, but he's not a terrible poet. He's one of yours.
He is one of ours.
Yeah, I never felt drawn to his work as a reader at all. And so it was with a little bit of hesitation that I ended up using that epigraph and making it the title of my book. One of the things that I found about him that was interesting is that he had a brother who was addicted to opium. So the coincidence of that sibling dynamic felt almost like it was a message that was being sent to me.
Wow.
that should be the title of the book. But I'm not off the record. I'm not a huge Tennyson fan.
Oh, but you're going to get called up for all the Tennyson fandom now.
So true.
What about you, Sadie? Tennyson fan?
I have to confess, I didn't do him at school, and I hadn't really read that much.
Mm.
So, I have to admit,
no,
I'm not a fan.
Poetry is one of those things I've had to come back to, you know, and approach at very different angles.
I love poetry, but we did very limited the poetry we did at school. I don't know. I was arrogant about the poets I didn't like.
Yeah,
like Betjeman. Yep. I was phenomenally rude about, and I loved Eliot, so I was extremely arrogant about the way they taught me that. And I was arrogance is coming up a lot. that ignorance of youth where you know what you love and you know what you're into and you don't want to be told anything.
Yep.
So you kind of go through life trying to break down your own prejudices, or I do, I think.
Oh, you don't worry about talking about arrogance. You're talking to a guy who, at uni, used to stick a copy of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas in his back pocket because he thought it made him look literary and cool. I'd not actually read it at the time.
I bet it did, though.
I'm not sure about that. So, Sadie, as I said, The Snakes, this is your fifth novel now. It's a morality tale at heart, wouldn't you say?
It is, and... it's really interesting listening to Liz, everything that she says about not wanting to moralize and not wanting to preach. And, you know, it has similarly themes of addiction. Similarly, it's a very dark book. It's about, even though the parallels are many, I think, between these two books. So the family in mine, there's a young married couple and the woman comes from a lot of money and... a very high social situation, but her family is extremely dysfunctional and sort of riddled with addiction and horrible behaviours and cruelties within the family. So like Liz, in order to tell that story, the only way really to do it was to make it a book that you couldn't not read.
Mm.
Because I wanted to... You know, in some ways it was a Brexit novel and a Trump novel, and I wanted to talk about, you know, the way the world is. And to do all that, for me, I had to come at it sideways, and I had to make it, it's not a light book by any stretch, but I had to make it a compulsive book, and I had to sort of take the engine of a thriller, even though it's not a genre book, just because the weight of those things can be... dreary. And actually pain isn't dreary. It's very urgent. And there's a sense of sort of when you're in grief or in pain or having a difficult time, you are in a sense of have a sense of terror and not knowing what's going to happen next. So the way to tell the story was to do it that way for me.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think, like I was saying with Liz's book as well, you know, it is a page turner. And yet, you know, this is a it asks a lot of questions about human nature, which you might associate with a slightly different style or genre. But this it's a human nature thriller.
Yeah.
You know, and that is and that's what it makes it really interesting as well, I think, as a reader, because you're getting quite a lot of that darkness, but in a sort of page turny way.
Yes.
And you were talking, you mentioned Bea and Dan, who are the married couple, and there's also Bea's brother Alex as well, who plays quite an important role in the story.
Yes, he's the addict in the story. Bea and Alex come from this very, very rich family, and she has turned her back on it because it was such an unhappy childhood that she had. And her brother is still, through his addiction and not being able to manage his life financially, he's still very much attached to both parents in different ways and bankrolled by the father. And he's running or attempting to begin to run a very an abandoned hotel, really small hotel in the middle of France. And he's just battling his demons alone with a sort of fantasy that he will open it to the public and have a going concern. And Bea and Dan come to stay with him at the beginning of what's going to be a trip around Europe to take some time out from their lives.
And she's very happy to and wants to live off by her own means, you see, even though her father is this property developer and has got all this money, but she just doesn't want anything to
do with that. She has made a firm decision to have nothing to do with the money or anything about the money, and her husband, who has come from no money at all and has had to fight for every single thing that he does, as he discovers, really, I mean, she hasn't kept it a secret that there was money, it's just that he hadn't seen it before.
Yeah.
And when he then encounters her family and the way that they live, and he glimpses the money that they have, then it drives a wedge between them.
Well, this made me think how powerful money is. In terms of how it can change a person, and in the case of your story, Dan, because Dan's character just changes when this money is involved, and it started making me think about, you know, everyday situations where you hear of friends or, you know, friends of friends or whoever who've just been totally changed by money for good or for bad, or often for bad.
Yeah, completely. I think we all like to think it wouldn't change us. We all think that we'd be okay. In that marriage, it's not that he doesn't love her, but when money is added in, it becomes this enemy to them.
Yeah.
Because it is so seductive. And I think we're foolish if we deny how powerful money is.
Mm. If we think of Kensington Avenue again, Liz, and, you know, think about that and the problems of this opium crisis and everything, from a sort of angle of money, is it something money can just solve, or is it so much deeper than that, do you think?
I think in the States it's more of a question of solving our problems around healthcare and privatized medicine, because the opioid crisis in the States is, I think, so problematic because doctors are incentivized to prescribe opioid medication by pharmaceutical companies who wish to make a huge profit. So yeah, money is insidious in that way.
Incentivized in that the doctors might get a little cut?
Basically, a specific pharmaceutical company, Purdue Pharma, owned by the Sackler family in the U.S., underemphasized or denied how addictive certain prescription narcotics were beginning in 1996 with OxyContin, and marketed them as non-addictive, explicitly non-addictive, and would in effect bribe doctors through the use of, for example, like fancy vacations or fancy dinners or free gas money, things like that, to write many, many prescriptions for these pills. The pills then infiltrated the population, the population became hugely addicted and then couldn't get them through prescriptions, so would buy them on the street. That became too expensive and so turned to heroin. And that's the Cliff Note version of how the crisis began. And now it's sort of rampant. And as we know, opioid medication sort of irreversibly alters the brain. And so recovery is certainly possible, but quite difficult. And so we're still figuring out how to achieve what the best pathway is to recovery for people with specifically addiction to opioids.
And as I said earlier, you did go and do a lot of research and volunteer work, and you spoke to a lot of people and you got their stories, but there are none of your characters are based on anyone as such. This is just, you've written pure fiction, but I suppose it was important in a way for you to be as accurate as possible, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities between all of the stories that I've heard. And so my fictional characters share the specific pathway to addiction that is almost universal to everybody I spoke to. So prescription pills followed by pills bought on the street, followed by a turn to heroin, which is cheaper and achieves the same result. So that's the same pathway. But you're correct that none of the characters is based on any one person, or even I wouldn't even call them a combination. They're invented. Yeah.
And you wanted to tell the story from a sort of then and now perspective as well. This runs through the book in different chapters.
Yeah, the book is the only chapters that exist are chapters called then and now. And the now is the present narrative wherein one sister goes missing and the other's searching for her. The then sections, at first in my mind, just served as kind of character development when this was a different sort of book. But slowly it became clear that they had to do more than that. And so the then sections now play an important role in solving the present day mystery. And that's the reason for being for those chapters.
We've talked a bit about Liz's title. Did you come up with the title for your book, Sadie, before or after you'd written it? Or whereabouts in the process did it
The title
come from?
Thing is really strange. With nearly all of my books, the title has come at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And with this one, it did too.
With no story or anything attached to it?
I knew that it was, you know, that the family were a nest of snakes. I knew that it was going to be essentially, you know, a tragedy, and that it would have these sort of biblical themes. But I hadn't worked out the story yet. I was still, you know, in that very early stage of kind of working out who people would be and where we'd be and where we'd be in time. So, but it came, yes, and it helps me a lot to have that. You know, what is the book about? It's about snakes. They're metaphorical snakes, and I know that I'm doing that, and that's helpful. The only book that didn't happen for was The Uninvited Guests, which was originally called Emerald Torrington's Birthday and the Accident on the Branch Line, which I really love. My editor didn't.
Oh.
So, but the others, they've all come up quite early, and I really loved that one, actually, but I can see that it might not fit on the cover and all of that. So.
Well, it hasn't stopped other titles, has it? You know, let's be honest.
It's the only one that there's been that sort of workshopping thing, which is very unnerving, naming things. If you've got the name, you feel a certain security about it, and something without a name feels sort of headless.
Right. Mm-hmm. Do you feel the same, Liz? You're nodding there?
I'm the opposite. Every single one of my titles arrived toward the end of the writing process.
Really?
And I've gotten into the bad habit, I don't know if it's a bad habit or it's just what I do, of taking my titles from other works. Usually it'll be part of what becomes the epigraph of a book. I don't know. I like other people's turns of phrases better than my own, I guess. But that's what I did with this one. I had a terrible title, it was so bad that I won't even say it, right up until just prior to submission of the manuscript, at which point I kind of like quarantined myself into a room for a whole workday and just read every text I could find that had anything to do with addiction. So poems and prose and songs and films and finally came upon that Tennyson quote in the nick of time. So,
so you did have a title, not that you're going to tell us, but there was a title on the manuscript, was there? When you were, so it wasn't just untitled draft.
It was a title that I knew I couldn't, like, it was a bad title.
Got it, okay.
Which is almost worse. I should probably just have used untitled.
Untitled. Yeah.
I really want to know what it was.
I do as well now.
I'll tell you after the recording session.
Okay, we're going to hold it to that. But actually, you know, you saying, I don't know if it's a bad thing or a bad habit or anything, I know loads of art that has come from other titles, and you know, certainly in music, if you look at music, bands are named after songs of artists that they love and things, and I just think that's great because it helps you discover other pieces of music, other books, other work, you know.
Yeah, I agree. And then there's that sort of resonance that a thing has, that you may have read the source and not taken it in, but there's something about that title that then it carries so much with it. So,
but also, we're talking about a novel published in 2020 now by you, Liz, and at the beginning of it is a Tennyson poem that many, many people won't ever have read or know about, and it's sort of it's giving it a new contemporary audience, isn't it? Whether people like it or not.
Right, that's true, and it also speaks to the idea that opioid addiction is not a new phenomenon.
Not a new
thing.
There
have been so many waves of it in various moments in history.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
So it's time for the book off now, where each of you gets to tell us about a book that you absolutely love and you think we should all read and the reasons why. And at the end of it, I've got to choose which one I'm going to take home. You each get 3 minutes on the clock, but you don't have to use it. If you want to just pitch the book in 2 minutes, that's fine too. But if and when you get to 3 minutes, you'll either be honked out at your time or you will be rung out, as is tradition on this podcast. So, first we need to decide who's going to go first and who's going to go second. So, Sadie, I'll give you the option to choose first or second.
I'll go first.
She's going first. Which means, Liz, you get to decide if you would like to be rung out or if you would prefer the honk.
I'll be rung out.
You will be rung. Okay. In which case, I will put 3 minutes on the clock now. And before we start, Sadie, tell us about, just tell us the book that you're going to be talking about.
It's a book called Flambards, which is the first in a series of three, and then much later a fourth, written by a novelist called Cam Payton.
Fantastic. Well, there's 3 minutes on the clock now, so it's over to you to tell us about Flambards.
Cam Payton is still alive. She's 90. She was born in 1929. I think that Flambards was one of her first novels that she wrote. It came out around about 1969, I think. It's set at the turn of the, at the beginning of the 20th century. It's a one of those children's books that's really an adult book. You could read it at any time. It's about a girl, Christina. It starts when she's 11. She's an orphan in the tradition of all great children's stories, but long enough ago that she's not tragic about it. And she's sent from her aunt in London to live in the country with her uncle and his two sons. And it's an entirely new world for her. It's a falling down house. The uncle was crippled in a hunting accident. One of the brothers, her cousins, is very sort of brutal fox hunting, virtually illiterate, and the house is falling down around them. The other brother is this sensitive, hunting-hating, sort of a born liberal, very intellectual, dreams of flying aeroplanes. And Christina is a sort of perfect heroine. She's very practical and tough and full of action. But her dilemma is really the dilemma of the book. Which of these boys does she relate to? Is she going to fall in love with fox hunting and this old way of life? We're in about 1910. Or is she going to move into the future? So it's romantic. It sounds like a romantic novel, but it's actually, it's about the old world dying and modernity stepping in. It's set on the eve of the First World War, which is an adult reader, even as a lot of children would know that. The house is a character in the book. It's falling down around their ears, the uncle dragging his legs around it, yelling drunkenly. There's something of the Bronte-ishness about it, but her writing is incredibly spare. And like all really great writers, and I think Karen Payton is a great writer, it's sort of genderless. It's not a romantic book with a small r, but it has this huge passion for life. It's about the class system as was. It's about old England. It's about the brutal and the thoughtful. It's about so many things. And really what's fascinating most about it is that this, what begins as a tyrannical old man with this bullish way of life, in by the end, you realize it's a fragile life because it's on its way out and everything is being swept away. So the people who, and that's why it's a mature work and not a romantic work, because it has this vision of the 20th century.
Oh, fantastic.
Very good.
That was fab. You were really in the flow there as well. I knew there was more coming. I didn't want to have to honk you out.
No, I'm just going to sit thinking what I left out.
No, I think you did.
How do you spell the title? F-L-A.
Flambards.
F-L-A-M-B-A-R-D.
It's the name of the house.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's, it's fantastic. A great book.
Sounds
and
great.
All three of them are fantastic. Then the fourth one written later on. It's a world you just want to be in.
Yeah, those are the best books.
Well, you can have a well-deserved rest now, Sadie, because it's over to you, Liz. I'm going to put 3 minutes back on the clock just before we start. Which book are you going to pitch for us today?
I'm going to talk about Life Among the Savages by Shirley Jackson.
Fantastic. Okay, 3 minutes over to you.
Okay. I'm going to talk about this book and why it's meaningful to me. And I'm also going to talk about why I think it's universally meaningful. And then if I have time at the end, I'm going to read a little bit of it just to get a feel for the language. So Shirley Jackson is best known, obviously, for works in different genres. The Lottery is her most famous short story. She wrote The Haunting of Hill House, We Have Always Lived in the Castle. She's famous for writing kind of gothic-y horror genre stuff. But she also had this other life as the mother of four young children. She and her husband were both writers, although she was the more successful of the two and ended up becoming the breadwinner, but was still kind of expected because of the era in which she was writing and because her husband wasn't that nice a guy, to act as the homemaker and the housewife as well. So she had, partly to pay the bills, she began to publish these short essays in women's magazines, like Good Housekeeping, also some in magazines like Harper's, I think, about life at home, which she was, some critics disparaged her for. I think Betty Friedan was very opposed to the idea that Shirley Jackson would write about her own domesticity in this way and thought she was setting women back. But when you actually read those collected essays, which became this novel, this collection of essays, Life Among the Savages, you realize that she was extremely subversive. And to me, this book came along at a moment when I needed it the most, because it's all about writing and parenting young children, which is what I am doing right now. So I have an 8-month-old and a 3-year-old at home, and I am traveling on a book tour, and I'm teaching full-time at a university called Temple in Philadelphia, and I'm trying to hold down some semblance of a family life and trying to work on a screenplay and trying to work on a novel, and I mostly just feel like I'm going crazy at all times. And Shirley Jackson, through this book, provides a sense that it's possible to do that, but also more than just saying, like, you can do it all in a cavalier way. She also acknowledges the extreme injustice of what I think women of her era were asked to do and what women are still being asked to do, the whole idea of a kind of second shift. I think it's universally appealing because she writes so, her prose is so beautiful and funny. And anybody, man or woman, people with children or child-free people, can relate to the idea of somebody trying so hard to write and just being undermined constantly, trying to so hard to do any pursuit and being undermined constantly in that pursuit. It looks like I might not have time to read, but you should all read it.
That was very good as well. Lovely. How much were you going to read? Because even though the time's up, I'd quite like to hear a bit of Shirley Jackson. I don't know about you, Sadie, but I think maybe a little snippet of Shirley would be good.
Just a tiny bit. The best line is the last one. I'll read the first one instead because the last one doesn't make sense out of context. Our house is old and noisy and full. When we moved into it, we had 2 children and about 5,000 books. I expect that when we finally overflow and move out again, we will have perhaps 20 children and easily 500,000 books. I'll stop there. It doesn't do it justice. The whole context of the piece ends, I cannot think of a preferable way of life except one without children and without books, going on soundlessly in an apartment hotel where they do the cleaning for you and send up your meals, and all you have to do is lie on a couch. And as I say, I cannot think of a preferable way of life, but then I have had to make a good many compromises, all told. So the whole thing is her acknowledging that, like, actually raising little kids is a thankless task, and saying that aloud in 1953 is sort of very subversive to me.
Yeah, and probably quite brave, really. Mm-hmm. I'll come back to talk about Shirley. That was a fab pitch. Thank you very much to both of you for those. K.M. Payton is someone I don't know, I'm afraid, but instantly, the moment you said it's a children's book that an adult can read, you know, it's a children's book that's an adult book. I love children's books and children's literature, and I love those books that you can read when you're younger and then still talk about them and return to them when you were an adult. So did you read it as a kid?
I think I first read it, I was probably 11. And it's because it follows Christina's life from when she's 11 to her going, when she goes to the Hunt Ball at the end of the first book. So it's really a coming of age book in lots of ways. It's romantic. It has a bit of kissing, but it doesn't feel like a teenage book. But just because she's so good, and she was an incredibly prolific writer. She wrote first under a different name, Boys Action Stories, I think in the 60s or even in the late 50s.
Oh, right.
And then she took her name, but with the initials. It was her husband's name for the M. Otherwise, she just would have been K. Payton. And she wrote, I mean, dozens of novels. And she won the Carnegie Medal, was shortlisted for a lot of times. Yeah. She won the Guardian Book Prize. She was one of the first, because she wrote quite a lot of horse stories and quite a lot of sailing stories and quite adventure-y stories, often with male protagonists. She had a... She was one of those 70s children writers who was writing against that sort of nice girls and ponies pony books, you know, where everyone is middle class and everyone is well off.
Bit Jolly Hockey Sticks.
Very Jolly Hockey Sticks, the whole sort of Enid Blyton thing and the Pullen Thompsons and all of those. She was, you know, a social realist. Yeah. She wrote about one of her pony books called Fly By Night is about a girl who's, you know, sort of middle, kind of lower middle class. Parents have never seen a pony. She just has this weird aberration, and they live in this small terraced house in a modern sort of suburbs of some smallish city. Mm. And she does this crazy thing and gets, they've got no money, and she does a paper round and she has it in the garden, and there's nothing Jolly Hockey Sticks about. Even that sounds kind of cozy. She's not cozy at all. She's quite a harsh writer. And to do that for children and older children, and for your prose to stand up down the decades, she deserves a vast reputation.
And to be writing, like you say, for children in a way about, you know, that being, are you going to go down this liberal path, or are you into the hunt? Is that,
yes,
is that,
exactly,
you know, is that how you
and
are,
to be doing
drawn?
That at the end of the 60s was quite subversive still, I think.
Two subversive writers here. And then, of course, Shirley Jackson, I mean, a collection of essays can be a really wonderful thing, can't it, anyway? It's much like short stories. You know, I love short stories. I love having a short story collection by the side of the bed just to dip into and things. But it's interesting hearing about Shirley Jackson being definitely the breadwinner and the more popular writer, and yet because of that time and era and the husband, it's like, but you'll still have to, you still have to be the mum.
Hold down the fort.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you read it, or when you came across it, had you had your first child? Do you remember?
I think that I had. There was a biography about Shirley Jackson by Ruth Franklin called A Rather Haunted Life. And I read that first. So whenever that came out, you can check me on the publication date of that, is when I found
and then you
Life
came
Among
this.
Savages after that. Right. And then she has a second essay collection, which I haven't read, that's sort of like the adolescent years of her children.
Okay.
But there's an amazing anecdote that I didn't get to about when she arrives at the hospital to deliver her third child. The clerk doing the intake form says name, occupation. She says writer. And the clerk says, I'll just put down housewife. And that's sort of like this.
Oh.
That is the summary of the book.
Like, oh my God.
That should be the tagline on the back.
I'll
just put
we
down
love.
Just
put when down my first novel housewife. Was published, yeah. I was described as a housewife.
Ugh.
Were you?
And there was an article that says Sadie Jones, housewife's first novel.
That's,
you know,
insane.
I was like, okay.
Yeah.
But by the mere fact you've published a book, you're an author.
It was bizarre.
Yeah. That's so... how long ago was that, Derek?
I was 39, and I'd been, you know, a tax-paying writer for 15 years before then.
Oh my God.
But I hadn't had anything that anyone could point to, so I did have children, so then I was, I guess,
so that's
was.
It. Put in a box, yeah. I mean, I quite like the fact that you said it. Yes, if you can be a male, female, male, have kids, not have kids, it's still... you're still going to get something from it as well, which I think is, you know, it's quite a skill actually to be able to write like that. I've got to pick one. That's what happens here, and I have to say I loved this sound of both of them. And Kay and Peyton, maybe I should have known her. I guess because I didn't grow up reading them or something. I've missed out here, but it sounds like she needs to be more read, I think. And great that she's still alive. She's 90. Is she live from the UK?
Yes, she is.
Fantastic. And then, as I said, the collection of essays, I just love a great collection of things that you can dip into. And it sounds like it's got that classic sort of Shirley Jackson humour about it as well. Today I'm in a Shirley Jackson mood, so I'm going to take Shirley Jackson home with me. Okay, that's what I'm going to do. But I'm also going to go and check out Kay and Peyton, I think.
Good, yeah.
And
I can stand it.
There's four books in that series, is what you're saying,
there
right?
Are.
In the Flambard series. So, yeah, I might have to go and treat myself. Probably quite a nice present to give to a child now, maybe, as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're saying they stand up.
They really do.
Yeah.
And my stepdaughter was reading them, her new work, you know, in the 90s.
Right, okay, so. Okay. So there's loads to choose
from. She's still at it. There's loads to choose from.
Fantastic. And before I let you both go back out into the rain, obviously we've got these two fabulous books that are just out and just coming out in paperback. But what else are you working on at the moment? Liz, you're over here for a little while, obviously.
I'm working on the evolving screenplay for Long Bright River.
For Long Bright River, okay.
Yeah, primarily, and something else that I'm not ready to call a novel yet. So we'll
okay,
see. Yeah.
Untitled.
Untitled, yeah.
Very good.
It will be for a long time.
And what about you, Sadie?
I'm about halfway through a novel, and I haven't got a title for it yet.
Oh, so this is a bit different for you.
And it's making me feel very nervous. I don't like it. And I've started going through poems looking for... I'm just not sure. It makes me feel like I don't know what I'm doing, but then what's new?
Hey, but you know, maybe this will be the change of your style, in that the title will come at the end.
Maybe. And that would be
okay. And all will be well. Yeah, absolutely. It would just fit it in with what you've written.
Yeah.
The Snakes by Sadie Jones is out now in hardback and in paperback from the 20th of February, published by Vintage and Long. Bright River by Lismore is out now, published by Hutchinson. Thank you both so much for joining me for those fantastic recommendations.
Thanks
for having me.
Cheers, thank you.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.